You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
From our studio to yours, this is Various Artists.
Ahi ahi mari e, tēnā koutou katoa, ko me e toku ingoa.
Ko sofia toku ingoa. Nau mai, haere mai ki Various Artists mō tēnei wiki. We have a packed show today, so we're going to get right on into it. Efaia kene, coming up on the show today, Maya, what have you got?
Yeah, I caught up with two of the artists showing at Ivan Anthony's new show, Providence, Sophie Gregg and Erica Holm. Sophie, what have you got?
I had a kōrero with artist Claudia Jowett about Tale, a group show she facilitated currently on at Melanie Roger Gallery, and I had a kōrero with artist Simon Denny about his show The Future, currently showing at Michael Lett Gallery.
He aha ofakara, we would love to hear your thoughts on these pieces. So tuku patsahi mai, you can text us on 5395 rimatoru iwarima, waimairane, or give us a call in the studio on 309-3879.
Also, after the show, koa e ware ware e ahea na koutou, te whakarongo ki e nei kōrero anō, hei pakihere roki roki maronga i te pai tuku tuku o irirangi pōho me haere ki 95 BFM, irakati.com. You can catch all of these chats and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Let's get into the show.
What's it all for?
Various Artists.
Tale is a group show exhibiting artists Serene Hodgman, Claudia Jowett, Sione Monu, Ahi Lapalapa Rands, and Salome Tanuvasa, currently on at Melanie Roger Gallery. Facilitated by Claudia Jowett, the show sees the artists weaving and plaiting together histories and traditional practices of the South Pacific from a contemporary diasporic lens grounded within their respective whakapapa, transforming the space into one of vibrance and joy through their mixed mediums and approaches. I had a kōrero with Jowett about the making of the show, and those included.
Okay, Nisa Mbolare, Naya Thango ko Claudia Jowett. My name's Claudia. I'm an artist, as well as a few other things to, you know, earn money and keep it going. So this project came about. I'm an artist represented by Melanie Roger Gallery, and I wanted to do a show that represented a kind of diverse range of artists from the South Pacific diasporic making community. So I had initially thought of working with, you know, artists that I love and admire, of course, that always helps, and then expanding it out to a more kind of fulsome idea of range of practices and range of influences across the South Pacific. I'm also in the show, which is always kind of a slightly funny thing, but I'm the sort of represented artist from Melanie in the show. And then we've got a range. There's Salome Tanuvasa, who's represented by Tim Melville Gallery, Serene Hodgman, who's based in Australia now, Ahi Lapalapa Rands, and Sione Monu.
Beautiful. I want to talk a little bit about the exhibition title itself and
yes,
how it's kind of relating to the exhibition as a whole. In Fijian, Tali means to plait or interweave.
Yes.
Do you want to kind of speak to this choice of title a little bit and how it kind of relates to the approach taken in the making of this exhibition?
So in my own work, I often will use Vosovakaviti Fijian titles as a kind of a learning mechanism as well, as I learn the language, and also an idea that, you know, it's harking back to my whakapapa, but it's also this process of learning and engagement with an Indigenous language. The process of plaiting or weaving together, this kind of refers quite specifically to the process of making mangi mangi, which is like a braided coconuts in it. And to me, it kind of spoke to this idea of weaving different influences, different artists, different lineages together to create the show, and this kind of forming shared ideas or shared, you know, there's a lot of crossovers in the South Pacific as well. Yeah, this process of bringing things together to create a whole was a little bit poetic.
Yeah. No, it's beautiful. This show is, of course, presenting new and recent work by yourself and four others. Do you want to kind of walk us through who's in this exhibition and the works that they're exhibiting and their practice?
Yeah, so I think we all are, some of the shared things that we have between us is that we are all sort of creating work either in Aotearoa or Australia from the perspective of kind of contemporary diasporic makers and what that means. So we're drawing on kind of heritage arts, some more obviously than others, and having this contemporary spin on it. So I think that was quite an important viewpoint to platform. We've got a lot of sort of similar sensibilities in the way we might approach kind of adornment or kind of patterns, rhythms, references. You know, there's a lot of shared connections we can make there. There are, say, someone like Salomu Tanuvasa, who practices more abstract, and even mine, I would say. So the references there are a little more kind of inbuilt versus like, say, Serene Hodgman, who's drawing more on Te Vaivai kind of influences, or Ahilapalapa Rans, who is drawing on this lineage of Hawaiian banner making and using some obvious like referential images of flora and fauna from Hawaii. Sione Mono is drawing on these practices of adornment in Tongan culture as well. So I think it's just this kind of idea of multiplicity, diverse approaches to what South Pacific practice can look like. But I think also there's this kind of underlying sense of it being quite, I don't know, it sounds kind of funny, but a little bit joyous too. Mm. Like it's going to be quite a fun install and quite a sort of a mixed presentation as well. I'm not really into this idea of it being this formalized, like this is this artist, this is this artist. It being more of a kind of shared, plaiting or weaving together of the themes that the exhibition is looking at.
Seeing what you can all look like in one space as opposed to just having like a wall sectioned each off. Or sections. Bringing it all together properly.
Yeah,
lovely. Just briefly, this show is of course coinciding with your new solo show at the Douse in Wellington, which is your first at a public gallery. It's congratulations. The exhibition features almost 50 works, both new and earlier works.
Yes.
And your works in Tully are a small glimpse at your practice too.
Yeah.
How is it working with director and curator Carl Chittum on the show?
Oh, it was a really great experience. I think it's that funny thing too where when you are constantly producing new bodies of work, it's a really interesting thing to be able to go back and contextualize your own practice against your own kind of lineage of making.
Mm.
That was awesome. I mean, he had to rein me the hell in because that was, you know, I'm a more is more kind of gal. So that was really lovely. And also to contextualize it down in Pōneke, where my family's got so many connections to, was really amazing as well. And to create new work. And I think it's sort of the exhibition with Tali kind of is quite a fortuitous timing because I've been re-examining the connections to Fiji and what that means to be like a contemporary South Pacific maker. So I think in the selection of artists I was thinking about who's doing that at the moment and who could create a really kind of interesting show. So it timed quite nicely in that way.
As you kind of touched on there, like I want to talk a little bit more about your curatorial vision, I guess.
Facilitation vision.
How did you kind of go about selecting artists? Can you take me through like start to finish what that looked like?
I think it starts off like, who do I like? Whose practice do I really kind of fangirl for a little bit? Because I think that always makes it really easy to work with people you admire and whose practices really interest you. Like, I think that's always got to be the starting point. And, you know, they're my peers as well. There's this thing of like, I think when you're working in communities like this, you want to uplift people as well that you go with. Not that they do their own thing, you know, they don't need me. But it was just this thing of like, oh, these people are really great and I want to work with them, you know. The more opportunities that we can kind of have collectively, I think is important as well. So that was my initial starting point. And then I was thinking of initially I had kind of thought about, because I've a work that wasn't included in the Douse and is sort of a future step. I was making a textile work based off a Fijian process of dua mat making, which is fabric scraps. So initially I was thinking about textiles but then it sort of shifted and changed and I started to think about this process of adornment, this process of kind of mark making that we have in the Pacific and what that can look like when it's slightly more extrapolated from heritage arts. I think there's there's maybe an idea of kind of what quote unquote looks like Pacific art. So I was interested in makers too that were kind of exploring that in a contemporary sense as well. I think that's kind of the standpoint that I started at, and it's shifted and changed along the way, as any good process should. And I think it will shift and change as we do the installation as well. More connections will be made, or there might be more points of interest. You know, and I think there's this thing too when you're creating shared exhibitions where you've got to be a little bit led by the work as well, as well as the artist, of course, but what the directions the work is taking you, the connections you can make between works, some more obvious than others, to generate kind of potentially some slightly unexpected outcomes as well. Yeah.
For sure. Yeah, you touched on these connections between the work. Are you able to speak to maybe some examples that kind of stood out to you in that process?
Yeah, I think it's like even when I was looking at some of Salome's works for the options, I was like, there's some shared colour palettes, of course, but then even this process of some slightly more abstracted forms that might be mimicked in other works, or even this process of like one of the initial works I was drawn to of Salome's for the show is the Mum's Fala mat work, which is, it's a blown up portion of her Mum's Fala mat, but it kind of comes across as this quite abstracted form, but it has a lot of repeated mark making in it that I think crosses over very nicely with other abstract kind of works, or even in the process of Sione's beaded works and the forms he's making in those. It's this thing of, yeah, repetition, I think, mark making, form generating in a way, whether it's slightly more abstract or slightly representational. Then there's like Ahi with her, that, you know, like a slightly more obvious connection would be Ahi's use of textiles and then Serene's use of textiles, and the comparison and contrast, yeah, compare and contrast thing between their practices from two quite different Pacific perspectives and what that can look like, and also the influence of kind of non-traditional materials. You know, even in Sione's work too, with the use of beads and plastic flowers, you know, there's this always an interesting thing to me with Pacific practices where they will adapt and change to the environment that they're in. You know, and a more obvious use would be the use of calico instead of masi, or traditional natu or siapo, you know, the traditional fibre materials that is then replaced with a stand-in. So there's that process that's going on in the show too, of like what we're using in this context versus in a traditional context as well.
Yeah, gorgeous. Oh, well, I'm so excited to see the show. For those who do come to see it, like how do you kind of hope people engage with and view the works?
Well, to me, exhibition making, I want it to be accessible on multiple levels, because I think there's this, sometimes this thing that people can find art a little bit intimidating, or the process of going to an exhibition. So I think all of the artists represented in this show have a generosity of spirit in the way they approach their making, where it can be accessed on a level of, that's cool, from a very basic level, to a thing where it's like, if you dive a little bit deeper into the forms they're using, the titling I think is really important, particularly when it comes to Pacific work, that there's these deeper levels uncovered, the forms they're using, the connections back to homelands. So there's kind of, it can be accessed on different levels. So I think there's that thing of like, you're welcome to come at it whatever way you want to, you know, and that it's not this rarefied space that you have to have a giant art history background to understand. It's like we're making for the joy of it as well, you know. Come along and see some amazing people. The four people that I've chosen for this exhibition, I admire them as people and as makers, and I think they're doing really interesting work, adding to the kind of depth of contemporary South Pacific practice here. Yeah, so I think just come and support them. Come and support what they're doing. You know, it isn't a dealer gallery, but it's not just for people buying artwork. Yeah.
That was artist and facilitator of Tale, a group exhibition currently on at Melanie Roger Gallery, Claudia Jowett, speaking to me about the making of the show. Tale is on until the 4th of October.
Various artists, so you can go to the opening for more than just the snacks.
Providence is a group exhibition on at Ivan Anthony, the third of its exhibition series. Providence brings together a collection of artists, emerging, established, as well as European antiquities, pulling them together in space to create this rich cosmos of dialogue, a unique encounter between works that speak to this lineage of storytelling. I caught up with two of the artists showing work within Providence, Sophie Gregg and Erica Holm. Sophie Gregg produces mesmerizing paintings enriched with intricate webs of fairy tale-like fables.
Could you start off by introducing yourself and your overall practice a little bit?
Hi, I'm Sophie Gregg, and I'm a painter. I'm a recent graduate from Elam. And my paintings are very much inspired by medieval illuminations and Renaissance art. I am really drawn to the idea of paintings that are sort of little tableaus or scenes from stories or fairy tales or sort of personal narratives from my family, especially the women in my family. And so I guess I'm also really concerned with depicting these sort of female characters that live in this kind of symbolic world that's populated by all sorts of creatures and lots of demons that are always attacking them.
Gorgeous. And you currently have work showing in Provenance the Third, a group exhibition at Ivan Anthony. These works inhabit a real sense of storytelling, this quality of myth and folklore, while also being informed with this rich history of medieval and Renaissance. What draws you to the works of the medieval and Renaissance?
I mean, mainly I think it's that I grew up surrounded by that kind of historical art canon. My mum is a amazing artist herself who has always been really drawn to the work of old masters like Ribera and Caravaggio and all of the Renaissance artists. And so that was huge for her art practice, which had a really big influence on me growing up. And she's also a collector of all this crazy old religious artwork. So
your house was pretty full with all these works?
Yeah, it was about 10 Jesuses in every room. So it's really second nature for me, just where I draw all my inspiration from. I can't really help it.
Your own works have this real feeling of peering in on an alternate world and its beings, like watching a scene unfold within the confinements of the frame and at times being confronted by the subject staring back at you, breaking the fourth wall in a sense. Could you speak a bit more about this element of storytelling within your work? Where does this world of your paintings arise from?
Yeah, I've always been really drawn to fairy tales and folklore and oral histories. There's something about how these stories are so symbolic and so stripped back and often bizarre and grotesque that they have a way of talking around these big subjects that, you know, are the most important parts of our lives. I find it really interesting, the history of fairy tales, like if you take Red Riding Hood, for instance, that it became this like morality tale. But the earliest version of Red Riding Hood that we have has got a really complicated moral lesson to it. Red Riding Hood tricks the wolf by pretending she has to like go pee outside. It's like much more cutthroat and kind of ruthless than the version that we've grown up with. So there's this real getting to the heart of something. Like with Little Red Riding Hood, even though it's about this, you know, totally fantastical tale of a wolf, you know, kidnapping this girl, there's a way that it talks about how in danger little girls are in the world that feels so much more real than just discussing it up front. And so sort of folk tales and fairy tales and dreams are, you know, huge inspirations for me because they have this opaque, strange way of talking about things that feels so much more true than actually just discussing them in an intellectual way. They get to like the irrational, emotional truth. Yeah, I'm always trying to do that with my paintings. I want them to feel really true, even if I don't know quite exactly what I'm trying to directly say with them, but they should feel true.
And do they all like live in their own little universes, or do you feel like with each painting and with each project, you're kind of layering and building onto this world of your works?
Yeah, I definitely think of all of these women as living in the same universe. There's this narrative written by this medieval female writer called Christine de Pizan, called The City of Ladies, or The Book of the City of Ladies, where she writes about building a city where all of these great women throughout history and mythology all live together. And I really like that idea of building a world for all of these women to live in instead of collecting all these women together. And I feel like each woman has her own little story and her own little journey and little nugget of sort of psychodrama to figure out or represent.
Like our own little fable.
Yeah, exactly. And together they kind of represent what it is to be a woman and what it is to be a woman specifically within my family history. It's sort of a way of figuring out what it means for us to all be here and all be related to each other and all inherit the traumas and the histories that we've all gone through together.
Mm. And the imagery used within your work, are they informed by specific medieval or Renaissance references or memory or kind of like entirely imagined? You kind of briefly talked about it, but yeah, a bit more about that specific imagery.
Yeah, I mean, each painting comes together sort of like a Frankenstein's monster. Like they're stitched together from all these different references.
Mm.
Like my painting Catamenia, which is in Provenance right now, that was originally inspired by this little detail in a medieval illumination of a woman with this demon sitting on her big billowing skirts, and it's kind of like pulling her down. And I just loved that image so much, and I knew that I wanted to steal it. And from there, it sort of became also about the reference to Veronica's veil, a lady holding up the veil with a skinned rabbit on it, which is a reference to a personal family story, have come down to me like fairy tales, with references from, you know, Western art canon and things like medieval illuminations and things like that, stitching them together until they're their own alive body, like Frankenstein's monster. In the end, they always turn into these very like universal archetypal images and tableaus.
Mm. And housing these fables, these images and these characters of these women, your paintings often sit within these quite intricate architectural frames that act as this continuation of the painting, extending the world of the works while also acting as architecture itself, housing these figures and their worlds. Could you talk a bit more about these frames and their relationship with the painted image?
Yeah, the framing devices really came out of my frustration with just the rectangle and looking a lot at medieval paintings and how they existed as art objects as opposed to just two-dimensional things that lived on the wall. These were objects that were on church altars and were real solid things that had, yeah, this kind of architectural quality to them. And so I really wanted to try and harness that for my own paintings. There's something kind of insufficient about just the square or the rectangle or the flat surface that I was getting really, yeah, frustrated with, because I felt like I wanted to make a real home for these characters, these women. I wanted to build something that they could live in rather than just represent them. I wanted to bring them into this world in a really material way that felt solid.
Mm, beautiful. And I'm gonna switch it up a little, bringing it back into the materiality, into the process of your work. Your work showcases this really beautiful pairing of painting and drawing to create wonderful contrast within the works. Have you always explored this merging of your drawing and painting practice within your works?
I started really exploring the drawing aspect of my work kind of by accident. I was doing a year at uni where I was just studying for my BA in English and anthropology and working almost full time, and I just had no time to do any painting. And so I just let myself off the hook and decided no painting for a year. I'm just going to draw whenever I get the chance. Mm. And it was the best thing I ever did for my art practice, I think. It totally changed how I felt I should be painting. I think I used to kind of go on autopilot and just paint things in quite a traditional, realistic, figurative way. And so with the drawing, I learned that, you know, something could be finished without necessarily needing to follow all of those traditional techniques to a T.
Like a place to like kind of work things out, like without that kind of pressure of that finished painting.
Exactly. It gives you so much more freedom when you don't owe it to the work to make it this complete finished thing in the way that you have kind of been programmed to think it must be finished. And a lot of my favorite artists, like Holbein is an amazing drawer, and some of my favorite works of his are just these really simple portrait drawings. And I looked a lot as well at the etchings of Ulbricht Dürer. And then when it came to merging painting and drawing together, there's actually this one painting by Van Eyck that was left unfinished, a painting he did of St. Barbara, that I just got so fixated on and obsessed with. Because even though the end result is unintentional, like it was just left unfinished, there's this really magical quality to it of the blended drawing. It's got this really magical quality to it with the drawing on the underpainting left exposed and just this smoky background sky put in. And so for a lot of my last year at Elam, I was kind of trying to chase that quality that one painting had, mm-hmm. Without it being this kind of like horrible gimmicky thing of like, oh, I'm leaving my painting half unfinished. Mm-hmm. I wanted it still to be this like very finished, very resolved outcome, but capturing that softness and sharpness that a drawing can achieve that is hard to do with just painting.
Mm. And this painting process, could you talk a bit more about that? Do you undertake quite a traditional painting technique?
I definitely draw really heavily from traditional painting techniques. I used to paint in quite a traditional Flemish style, where you do a grisaille layer or a dead painting, which is just done with white and like raw umber or something like that. And it's just a monochromatic rendering of the image. And then you glaze over that with various layers to get this really realistic kind of effect. And so in recent years, I've been trying to push these really traditional techniques into these more unconventional spaces. But these days, that's kind of the main bulk of the painting that I do, is just this kind of ghostly layer, just painting with white or just doing a single monochromatic glaze over the top of a dead layer and letting the drawing and the color of the panel underneath come through as the shadow.
Mm. And within this exhibition, your works sit amongst the beautiful works of others, including the works of Andrew McLeod, Liz Moore, Francis Youp Richard, to name a few, as well as collected European antiques. How does it feel having your paintings sit amongst these works?
Yeah, it's pretty surreal and humbling. I mean, in a double sense of these artists that I've looked up to for so long, and like I'm so inspired by Liz and Andrew and Francis, and then also, yeah, very similarly humbling to be amongst all of these old antiquities, and especially because I feel like art from the pre-modern era has this quality to it that I really wish and I hope that one day I can capture in my own work, that I think comes from the fact that these were really functional objects. They were devotional images or images that served like a social purpose, like portraits. There's this kind of egolessness to the works where the artist is really not present in them. And yeah, I really hope that even though so much of my work is really personal and is about my family, the end goal is for it, each painting to be its own thing that stands up on its own, even if you didn't know anything about me and I was just some anonymous maker, that the painting would still have as much power.
That was Sophie Gregg speaking to me about her work within Providence. I also caught up with artist Erica Holm, who creates these beautiful sculptures enriched with ritual and human connection. Would you like to start off by introducing yourself and your overall practice a little bit?
Kia ora, I'm Erica Holm. I'm an artist based in Tamaki, Auckland. I primarily work in sort of sculpture, installation-based sort of practice, a lot of wood, metal, kind of sort of hard materials and casted objects and things. I sort of work between kind of like a furniture making idea and then also the body as well. A lot of like kind of bodily materials and then images of the body too.
Wonderful. And you currently have a work showing in Providence, a group exhibition at Ivan Anthony. In this, you present your work Cheek to Cheek, a beautiful oak and pine carved bench with intricate carved braid detailing that seems to speak to this religious cosmos and the medieval. What draws you to the ideas and the aesthetics of these worlds?
It's really the sort of ritual elements of those worlds. It's the idea that you have these kind of like religious objects, things that are really heavily associated with a particular process that you might do in prayer in a church or things like that. And not really thinking about any sort of specific religion, but sort of just the whole concept of having these like devotional objects involved in ritual. And then I think a lot about those kinds of ritual objects you have in your everyday life. I've specifically been looking a lot at like romantic objects that you have with your partner, like, you know, your toothbrushes or something, or your two pillows, and thinking that we have these rituals that we do together in this house, and these are the objects that we use to do those rituals. In the same way that you sort of, you know, you have God on your side because of these objects, you sort of like, oh, we have these special toothbrushes in bed with us, so therefore our relationship is good, you know, we are pious, you know, because we have these beautiful little ritual objects.
Yeah, these objects that, yeah, are shared in a daily ritual. They're not just like a dormant object that sits there, but one that is like craving the body to interact with it.
Yeah, all of these. I mean, that was the work Cheek to Cheek. It kind of, it's a bit yuck, but it came from kind of thinking about like double-ended sex toys and things like that, and how they're like a connection between two people, you know.
And these objects also all kind of have this connotation with this act of devotion and prayer. Could you speak a bit to the decision behind these items of furniture? You did speak a little bit about them, but just a little more about their relation with these histories that you kind of draw from.
Yeah, the furniture sort of thing, I kind of started getting into it just because it was my old job, but I feel like the way that I think about furniture now is I'm usually thinking about like antique furniture specifically as the kind of images that I'm drawing on, because it is from a time when, you know, the ornamentation of an object really meant a lot to the person who had it. You know, you didn't just have a table because you could sit at it, but it was, you know, the legs of it were carved with some sort of detail that meant a lot to your family for many generations, or was part of some crazy myth or something. So that it's kind of why I'm interested in the furniture thing, because it's something contained within your home that you use constantly with other people, but it has a lot of kind of storytelling within it and the way that it looks kind of, you know, in a keepsake or something that's been passed down through generations, like an heirloom, I mean to say.
Yeah, because a lot of furniture now, they kind of have this lack
of human touch associated with them. Like, they come from these factories and stuff. They're not like these kind of laborious, time spent hands-on crafted objects. So yeah, you're looking more to that. Yeah, that labor of love and that like human touch associated with it, linked to the storytelling lineage of these objects.
I think this came to me. I think when I was moving out of my childhood home with my parents, and I was looking around the room, and the objects that were in there, and like the wooden walls and things, had these like deep gouges in them from really specific acts that had happened to me. And or like I remember like a specific fight or something, or like a specific time that I like banged my finger on something, and there was, you know, the object had beckoned me to interact with it or whatever. But that is so much of like what I guess like contemporary or modern furniture sort of has, where it's like the forms themselves don't really mean anything, but what happens to them, usually through interactions with the body, is kind of the thing that becomes the storytelling, where they're like ornamented with all of these like scratches from like very specific arguments or something, where or like a ding in it from like a really frustrating time you moved it, you know?
Yeah, no, they hold, objects hold such meaning and such, every little mark that really sparks something that I hadn't thought about. And within your work, you kind of reattach this bodily autonomy to these pieces, this kind of body connection, sculpting here into these wooden architectural objects, attaching a real bodily nature into its core structure. What informed this decision to carve these real bodily elements into the work?
It sort of started just thinking about the, so Elaine Scarry, her book, The Body in Pain, she talks a lot about like the body being able to be endlessly modified, and it kind of like hits the same sort of spots as like creation. Like the modification of the body is just like the creation of the body in a sense, where it like has the same sort of joy to it or joyousness to it. And I was thinking a lot about that, like, modification of the body. I know it's, like, such a classic sort of queer thing, body transformation sort of stuff and hormones and everything. But, you know, that there is this ability for the body to transform, whether that's, like, you know, voluntary or through, like, pain or some kind of surgery. But I was thinking a lot about how furniture kind of has the same capability to it, where... you know, as I was saying before about like a room getting dinged up or a piece of furniture getting dinged up, it's like endlessly modifiable. And when you're making a piece of furniture or something out of wood, it has that same process of like sanding and carving and machining and all of these like intense modifications to it. And I ended up really liking this parallel between the body and its modifications and like a wooden object and its modifications. And so naturally I just started like bringing them together and ornamenting little bits of the body into stuff in that like very Freudian fetish object kind of way, where like you see a bit of hair, just a braid coming out of something. And then I think Freud has these horrible things about like the cutting off the braid is like castration, you know, but then it also being like how the braid is such a pure thing to have, and how when you separate that bit of the body out on its own, it becomes such a fetish object to people and like has so many intense associations, like putting a big stomach on something or like putting a braid or putting a phallus on something, you know.
Yeah, and I feel like the braid also has, like it's got this real element of like another person attached to it. Like, yes, you can braid your own hair, but there is something about that act and that ritual of braiding your own hair, braiding someone else's hair, that kind of really connects people.
Yeah.
Is that something you're thinking about?
Yeah. Braiding is just like it's the ultimate like feminine connection between someone else. It's like, hey, having your hair braided together. Braiding your own hair, braiding someone else's hair. It's like, I'm always thinking about ways that the body connects with another body. And the braid is like, it's just the best one, I think.
I agree. It's wonderful. Within this exhibition, your works sit amongst the beautiful works of others, including works of Andrew McLeod, Liz Moore, Francis, Hugh Pritchard, to name a few, as well as collected European antiquities. How does it feel having your sculpture sit amongst these works?
It's really exciting seeing it in that room. Actually, I really love that show. I love how it looks. And I do love that. I really love that idea of showing old antiquities with new works. I think it's super interesting. I do, when I saw them in that room together, I did make me think a lot about that sort of uncanny idea about like you making work that looks really old, you know, is that how it's quite interesting when you have something that is actually really old next to it.
Almost like your work's like an imposter of sorts amongst these antiquities.
Yeah. I always say like Trojan horse in my mind when I'm thinking about like using like a really familiar color palette or really familiar material or form or something to like get an idea across, but sort of more subtly.
Yeah.
I really like that idea rather than being super obvious about it.
That was Erica Holm, and before that, Sophie Gregg, speaking to me about their work within Providence, a group exhibition at Ivan Anthony on until the 27th of September.
Oh, that's a good art.
We'll be right back.
Wow, we get along so well. I feel like I've known you my whole life.
I know, it's crazy. I'd love to see you again.
Sorry, I just have to ask. Your hoodie is so random. What is 95BFM?
Oh, I knew this was too good to be true.
What? Wait, where are you going?
No!
Show the world exactly who you are with our range of classic 95BFM merch. From the BSA slogan t-shirt to ringer tees and hoodies, get yours now at twotonesmerch.co.nz.
The original originator.
95.
You can listen to us while you're at home doing some chores, or you can take us along for tumble while you're driving and you're in a car.
Go to 95bfm.com for show podcasts.
Oh, my favourite jazz solo of all time. You know that one that's like...
Nah, I feel like they definitely improvise.
You guys still talking about jazz?
Yeah, just trying to work it out, man.
Do you know Grover?
Washington, Grover Washington, Limelight, great album.
Grover from the Muppets.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess so.
Does he like jazz?
All kinds of people love jazz. The 95BFM Jazz Show, Sundays at 12 with Blind Mango Chutney, Def Jim, Miss Dom, Francis Chan, or Dr. Mark Baines.
The 95BFM Jazz Show, 12 till 2 p.m. Sundays, thanks to San Ray.
Yes, darling, but is it art?
The Future is an exhibition presenting new and recent work by Berlin-based artist Simon Denny, currently on at Michael Lett Gallery. In channeling the spirit of era painting and Italian futurism, Denny employs contemporary methods of making with today's technology to create two new series of paintings whereby both mechanical and painterly qualities transpire, aiding in a recontextualization of 20th century modernism. I had a corridor with Simon Denny about the show and his overall practice.
My name is Simon Denny, grew up in New Zealand but living and working in Berlin, Germany, and I basically make art that's kind of inspired by the cultural signals of the technology business industry. Like, that's been my main focus for a long time. I'm a sculptor and an installation artist, but I'm also very involved in like technology as a medium, so I work with web-based things, I work with crypto-based things, I also work with AI. I just made a show here, which is bringing a lot of those interests together at Michael Lett Gallery, which is paintings primarily, and they're paintings made using AI and machines.
Before we kind of get into talking about the show at Michael Lett in particular, I want to kind of zoom in a little bit more on these ideas that do ground your practice. Mm-hmm. Your work has long taken an interest in the values and cultures of new technologies, inviting viewers to contemplate our proximity to their global impact through visualizing systems of competing political and economic visions, interrelationships of labor, capital, developments and technologies and impacts on the environment.
Yep.
In terms of this underlying theme in your practice, what kind of gravitates you and keeps you grounded in this exploration?
I mean, I would say first and foremost, it's like my own direct personal experience. I, you know, from the minute I was kind of like making art, it was very clear that consumer tech products, like in the wake of the internet. So I started making work in high school in the 1990s, and already the internet was coming, you know. Mm. And I just felt the profound impact it had on my life. And it's sort of the inquiry starts and kind of still stays in a way from there, right? I just feel very viscerally the impact of these people who make these products and the and the downstream effects they have on everybody. So I think that's like why I'm still engaged. But the more you look, the more there is to find in these things. And I think the cultural impact of those actors has only scaled up, you know. So I think today it would be easy to argue that technologists are potentially some of the most influential cultural actors in the world, you know. So I think coming from a cultural background, from an art background, and being interested in the value of culture, you know, I always feel there's a impetus to meet this cultural force as it comes at all of us, you know. So that's why. Yeah.
And that subject matter is always going to grow. I mean, it's rapidly becoming more of an issue and at the forefront of our concerns and the things that we have in front of us. And so I imagine that's constantly developing in your practice.
Yeah, that's the other thing, of course. Like there's always new things to work with, you know. There's many reasons for that. But I think, you know, I also think that cultural impacts, as you say, only grow.
For sure. Looking at this exhibition in particular, The Future, you've channeled the spirit of a major expression of the second generation of Italian futurism, aero pittura or aero painting, whereby through these machine-aided paintings, aerial landscapes and surrounding material kind of ground your subject matter. Do you want to start by speaking a little as to your relationship to this expression and how your use of it in this exhibition connects to your practice at large?
Yeah, Italian futurism is a very interesting thing. It's actually, I was going through my archives at home here because I'm visiting Auckland, and I looked back at my art history courses from the University of Auckland, and actually there seemed to be in the kind of 101 that I took on modernism, there was only one Italian futurist painting in the whole syllabus, which is interesting. So, but, you know, I got interested in it again now because some of these influential technologists and I would say like cultural influencers who also run these major technology businesses started being actively name-checking key Italian futurist people. And Italian futurism has an interesting history. You know, it came up in, you know, the fervor of the pre-war period and the pre-First World War in Italy around other avant-gardes. It looks a lot like cubism. It sort of has similar concerns to a bunch of different modernisms. But then after the First World War, it was very adjacent to the emergence of the beginnings of fascism as well. So it was like aligned with Mussolini. Mussolini was kind of in dialogue with all these actors. So it has a very strong political signal. But in the post-war period, it was then again recontextualized back into a kind of story of liberal modernism. So it's been kind of going back and forth in the way that it's seen between kind of a very authoritarian, kind of transgressive, violent thing back into also more kind of, you know, liberal, innovative kind of stories told about it. So I think it already contains all these things that I felt were politically very resonant for me. And the fact that these actors were kind of gesturing towards it was like, okay, this is something to work on for me, you know. But yeah, so this is why I started with it. And aero pittura is the kind of second wave that was much more seemed to be adjacent to Mussolini. And it was kind of halfway between a sort of an abstract capturing of speed and energy and stuff like that, but it was also kind of a depiction of the value of war. Very violent imagery, you know. And I was focusing on also the emergence of defense tech as a kind of as something that's becoming more visible in Europe where I live, also in America, but also here in New Zealand. And I think, you know, in Australia, the Defense Department has done a massive deal with this company that I was particularly interested in called Anduril, which make autonomous weapons and are working with the Australian government on producing autonomous submarine fleets. And the imagery that Anduril produces is unbelievably reminiscent of this aero pittura era. So it was not only kind of an intellectual signal, a text signal, but also this kind of visual cultural signal that was being embedded in this community. And so this is why I started looking in that direction. Yeah.
Looking at these paintings themselves, so these works have these strong qualities of pixelation, kind of further giving them these mechanical qualities, but also while maintaining their painterly texture.
Yeah.
The deployment of this pixelation quality like feels quite interesting for me, because I think pixelation has historically been quite like a negligible field of commercial craft, and you're bringing it into the world of contemporary art. Could you speak a little bit to the inclusion of this?
Yeah, I mean, that's also about another history that I got really interested in as well. Like in the 1960s, when computers were enormous and were only in universities, artists were invited in often to kind of play with early computing. And one of the first things they did was use what was called a plotter, that people who are doing architecture probably know about. It's like basically a robotic hand-ish thing that uses a pen to kind of make a line.
Right.
And this was like very early stuff, and there was amazing kind of computer art made all through the kind of 60s and 70s that used this idiom. And also, if you kind of got into that, that was also the beginning of display and, you know, pixels and display and the history of computation. And then, you know, more like consumer versions of that through screens, and pixel art came out, you know, alongside the PC. This was all kind of history that I got very fascinated with. In a way, it's kind of antiquated now, those kind of things, and the pixel itself is something that maybe signals to the past, but maybe like a different political past than maybe futurism does. This is what I found kind of interesting. But both were kind of embedded with histories of artists working with regimes, because often, you know, the beginnings of the internet and research institutes were also very close to government in the mid-century in the liberal West. So I don't know. I just thought that something about the pixel versus the versus lines of force, as they called it, from futurism, was a very interesting meeting point of all of these interests. And I also think like computer gaming, and which had a kind of pixel aesthetic, which is also a kind of a retro aesthetic now for many people, but was also very important, I think, in kind of a naturalizing the same type of language of violence and stuff like that that I was interested in with these paintings. So pixels are sort of part of the aesthetic story, but when it's all jumbled up and then painted again with a machine, it sort of looks strangely gestural and digital at the same time, or whatever. You know, it's had this weird uncanny where you sort of like, did a person make that gesture? Is that drip on purpose? Like, or is it something that is really kind of like, you know, a remnant of a pattern that a machine is like kind of outputting with no agency at all, you know?
The other series of works in this exhibition show you using this handheld labeling gun as a brush to copy marketing material for defense contractors and drone manufacturers in recent years.
Yeah.
How do you kind of see the relationship between that series and these machine-aided colorful painting series in the show?
It was a way for me to kind of bring gesture in a different way. So if the kind of machine painted plotter paintings, as I call them, that literally have a robotic arm dipping and brushing a brush with these color ones, that they sort of look pixelated, they sort of look stepped, and they sort of look gestural, but there's no hand that's touched them. Whereas if you can imagine this kind of label maker that I was using, you know, I literally drag the machine with my hand across the surface and print a kind of photographic image. So it's a weird thing where, you know, often when you print a digital image, it's sort of quite dry because, you know, like an inkjet print or whatever, it's sort of like, yeah, where is the person that printed that? You can't really find it. But with this way of kind of using this strange label maker, suddenly a photographic print from an inkjet printer gets all sorts of actual human gesture in it. So again, it's kind of like a mix up of where the agency is. Is it in my hand? Is it in the machine? You know, it was also a way of bringing this very strong contemporary imagery, I think, into the thing. There's something about putting something that looks like it made in the 1940s next to something which is kind of, in some ways, very recent. There's something of that that brings the location to where I wanted people to think about, you know, culture coming from.
We were talking a lot earlier, and I guess it's been running through the whole conversation today, about Italian futurism. And I guess, like, I wanted to come back to that after talking about your process, which is very contemporary.
Yeah.
How does this method of machine-aided painting aid in the recontextualization and recasting of early 20th century modernism? How do you kind of see that relationship and what that communicates in the works today?
I think the thinking that happened in modernism and the kind of action and the politics that happened in modernism during that period, you know, I'm talking between the First and Second World Wars, basically, including those wars, I think the thinking of that is not gone. And I think you get a lot of commentary around politics and the direction of the world today, which harks back to that period as a kind of a way of framing some of what's happening that we thought kind of went away after that period. Great power politics are back. So something that I felt when I was being maybe educated here, when I was a student in Auckland, was seen to be long in the past, never to return, has somehow come back. So I felt that using AI, something that was very contemporary, but also rooted in thinking of that time, that the thinking and the patterning for that was actually done during the Second World War as well, but has now kind of come to fruition in terms of power. I think there's something about bringing the imagery or the style of that, or even the thinking of that back, and putting it in front of contemporary viewers with a kind of digital, a clear digital filter in a way on top of that together, which has captured something of the strange back to the futureness of our time and our politics, and the strange, weird way where the impossible is somehow the most likely or whatever.
You spoke there about using AI, mm-hmm. and I like mentioned in the beginning of our conversation today how sometimes your work can look at the relationship between technology and the impact of the environment. Are there any kind of like ethical considerations that you find yourself really confronted with in that process?
Yeah, I mean, it's the whole thing's a massive ethical pickle, you know. And sometimes I've made work that kind of addresses that more explicitly. Like 5 years ago, I did a show in Tasmania which was called Mine, which was, I mean, you can imagine the implications of that. It was looking at the ethical and I guess environmental impacts of AI as it was starting to scale, because that was kind of the beginning of the moment when it was, you know. And yeah, all these kind of different types of resource extraction. I tried to make a kind of a connection, you know, between the type of extraction that was coming from the earth and the type of extraction and the mining that was being done of our kind of sociality on social media. So yeah, these are things I've packaged in different ways in different projects. For the work I'm doing at the moment now that we've been talking about, I think it's rife with ethical problems, but is, you know, not presenting any ethical resolution. You know, this is something I really wanted to be clear about in the tone that I took. I think it's a very confusing time ethically. I think the things that people thought made sense yesterday are changing a lot. And I think I wanted to capture some of that strange confusion and irresolution in the work as well.
I wanted to talk also, in this exhibition, there's also a sculptural work. Mm-hmm. Just to clarify, is this one of the works that was exhibited at Auckland Art Gallery for Optimism?
Yeah.
Tell me a bit about this work in particular. Why did you choose to also include it in the future?
Yeah, so this is a sculpture, part of a series that I make of diagrams that companies use to kind of copyright their ideas. So there's a process called patenting, where basically you come up with a very fringe in the future idea, and you quickly get it off to the patent office to disclose it to the world, but then also to own it in advance before it even exists. You know, it's a very interesting process in general, but like I got really fascinated for a period with the diagrams and that thing, because I kind of saw them as like sketches of the future. And there's a company here, as people probably know, like there's a company called Rocket Lab who's very involved between here and the US in launching stuff into space. And this was a drawing that they did for one of their kind of like engine shapes or whatever. And I made huge blow-ups of these drawings as kind of giant spaceships that were hanging in the Auckland Art Gallery for about a year. And they were sort of up there in the air, and I thought when they came down, one of them went into the collection of the Auckland Art Gallery, the other one came back to me. And then I thought, well, wouldn't it be nice to kind of like put that on the ground, you know? And I think some of the shapes of it also weirdly were reminiscent of these kind of fake futurist paintings that I was making. So there was a kind of morphological connection between that project and this one. So I just thought it would be crazy to walk into a room where there's this massive sculpture that's kind of made from another size and kind of a small room, and you're sort of overpowered by this bizarre, you know, UFO-ish shaped object that's kind of landed. I thought there was some nice metaphorical things that were happening there too. And then kind of going between that and looking at these paintings that had a kind of a reminiscence of the kind of mysticism of a kind of a cosmic shapes that are kind of in the paintings, you know.
Your work does seem to be quite globally focused as a whole, examining these new technologies with an understanding of their widespread impact. How do you kind of see your practice sitting in the context of New Zealand specifically, and how our relationships to those technologies and ideas?
Yeah, I mean, this is a constant dance for me, right? It's somewhat biographical and personal, and it's also, I think, quite interesting as a device. I think we are all kind of implicated, from New Zealand in particular, like in these kind of global conversations, but there are these very particular ways that we encounter them, right? So, I mean, the sculpture is a good example of that, right? Like, is Rocket Lab a New Zealand company? Yes, it is. Does it act in other parts of the world? Yes, it does. Is it embedded in all these things that kind of it controls and doesn't control between the domestic and the kind of international, and even maybe the intergalactic? Yes, it is, you know. So I think that's exactly the way that my work is often kind of played in, you know, like so I think my work is often triggered by these kind of tensions between what feels like something global and exterior and how it hits and embeds with New Zealand.
That was Simon Denny speaking to me about his show The Future, currently on at Michael Lett Gallery until the 11th of October.
Only positive critiques. Honest.
Various artists.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki māua mō tēnei rā.
That's all for us on Various Artists for today, our very packed show. Ngā mihi nui to everyone who spoke with us.
Claudia Jowett, whose group show she facilitated and is exhibiting in Tale at Melanie Roger Gallery, is on until the 4th of October.
Sophie Gregg and Erica Holm, whose work is showing within Ivan Anthony's Providence, which is on until the 27th of September.
And Simon Denny, whose show The Future is on at Michael Lett until the 11th of October. Nei rā hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in.
And remember, you can listen back to all of today's pieces on 95bfm.com or check out our Instagram at 95bfm various artists for more.
Ka hoki mai mātou a Te Rā Wiki. Next up is The Land of the Good Groove with Mari. My name is Sophia.
I'm Maya.
And that was Various Artists.
We'll catch you next week.
You're listening to 95BFM. Ka kite.
Ka kite.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.